Suffering voice, whack, whack, suffering voice, whack, whack, suffering voice, whack, whack, suffering voice, whack, whack, whack. Sovereignty never ceded. Welcome to the Black Block. Free CR. Broadcasting from Wurundjeri country. Sovereign voice. Black, Black Block. Free CR. They are.
Yay. Good morning. This is the Black Block, and this is a special day. It is the 70th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, 10th of December. And this whole morning here at 3CR has been awesome listening. I hope you've learnt a lot from it, because that's what it's been all about this morning. Thank you to Jailbreak just before. Here on the Black Block for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about human rights and its relevance here. And also we're going to really try and dissect this Genocide Convention, which also had an anniversary yesterday, being the 9th of December in 1948, that was adopted. And we're going to just, discuss that, as we do here on Black Block. And this is where I learnt a lot of information regarding, the details. And they're important details. I mean, they're sort of, might be boring or irrelevant because they're kind of legal, but that's what everything's based on. And on the show, we're going to have the usual Robbie Thorpe, resident expert on genocide. And, he's the one been punching this information for a long time, and I want to welcome him to Black Block this morning. Good morning, Rob.
Yeah, good morning, Viv. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me on. And, it's pretty fundamental law that needs to be addressed in this country. And like you said, it's been 70-odd years since the convention was first implemented on the back of the Second World War. And yet Australia still has no convention for its prevention, or no one's been punished over 70 years. So sort of get an idea why there's such a huge gap here in Australia between our people.
What we might do later on the show, and I know we have done it before, but we're going to talk about the case Thorpe v Commonwealth. A little bit later in the show, we'll sort of try and make some order here, as opposed to usually. But anyway, let's put it out there. What happened? What was your motivation?
Well, that was in 1997, by the way.
Because we've got a few other guests.
Yes. Okay, cool. That sounds really good, and I'm really glad that this is happening. I think this is pretty fundamental to what's occurring in Australia today with our people, our land, and the whole issue of international law, where it stands in Australia. So I'm really, really thankful that you're doing this broadcast today.
All right. Let's play a song, and then let's come back and we'll get right into the definition of genocide, how that was coined, where that all came from. All right, how's that sound, you fellas? All right, this is 3CR Radical Radio. This is the Black Block. We'll be back. Yossu Indy. Yossu Indy with Jailbreak there. All right, this is a special human rights broadcast day. Look, while we're waiting for our guests, we're doing a couple of live crosses today. I'm going to play an interview you may not have heard. It was an old one. It was with a couple of visiting academics, First Nations people from Turtle Island, who were experts on treaty in Turtle Island and how that went down, and we interviewed them here. I'm going to play that interview for you now. We're going to begin these treaty conversations with our two visiting guests, Myra and Kiera. I'm going to let you introduce yourself to the listeners.
Great. Thank you, Viv. Let me first acknowledge that we're on someone else's land. We come from Canada. We're both Indigenous scholars from Manitoba, but we recognize the traditional owners and give our respect. So my name is Myra Tate. I'm a master's in law student at the University of Manitoba. And my area of interest has been treaty implementation. So my treaty is one of the numbered treaties in Canada, Treaty Number 5 from 1875. And I look at taxation, which seems like a little bit of an odd fit, but I argue that we have to get back to the treaty relationship. That's the foundation of where we start in Canada.
Okay.
I'm Kiara Ladner.
And I teach in the Department of Political Studies at University of Manitoba. I come from Treaty 6, which was signed in 1876 in South Central Saskatchewan and South Central Alberta in Canada, center of Canada. And a res called Nigenit. We think of the territory as Okama Otsi, that place where thunder starts. And it's that place where I began my journey. I work in treaties and constitutional politics. Used to be just in Canada, but I've moved increasingly towards comparative study with Australia, Canada, and New Zealand.
Wow, that's just what we need.
What was the reasons they had treaties in the first place? Why did they come about? What was the call on that? And who called it? And right down to the roots of where did treaty come from?
Treaties started to be signed in Canada in 1624. I'm not great with dates. Meyer, if you know the date,
that's not long after Columbus, is it?
No, it's not long after Columbus, but it begins because already in 1537, international law specifies through the doctrine of discovery, where you get terra nullius out of, that treaties are necessary to obtain rights to land from indigenous people. And that the discovery gives a right to trade and to bring God, but to do anything other than trade or bring God, a colonial nation needed to actually sign a treaty with indigenous people to acquire land and to acquire, I guess, them in some respects in international law.
So going back to, what's that, early 16th century, they're well aware of these processes.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they were well aware by the time they got to Australia in 1780.
Oh, absolutely. And the notion of treaty making wasn't something that was started with the white fellas. We were treating amongst ourselves long before they showed up lost on the shore, right? So we discovered them floating by.
Refugee.
And it's important to understand that our treaties, from an Indigenous perspective, we're actually giving them rights to our land, them rights to hunt in our land, them rights to fish in our waters. We're giving them rights to come and settle and share our land, not the other way around. The Crown understands it as bestowing something upon us as an Indigenous people. Wrong. We have entered into a relationship and said, yes, we will share with you, and here's the grounds for it. Now, that lasts in Canada about 5 minutes. Right. And so when we look at the history of treaty making in Canada, we can kind of split it into three periods. We have our peace and friendship trading treaties, and that's pre-Confederation. So Canada becomes a nation in 1867. And we have examples of treaties that were signed then that had this idea of, we're two nations that will follow our own law and we'll follow our own ways of being and we'll live separately but with respect for one another. Confederation happens, 1867, and we enter into this period of great expansion as settlers pour into our land. So we end up having what are called the numbered treaties, 1 through 11. And I can tell you some of my study is on treaty number 1 coming out of 1871. And the reason that it's still an issue is the Crown has still failed to completely fulfill its promises out of Treaty 1. It's gone through numerous court cases, through our Federal Court of Appeal. It's gone back and forth several times. And in its last resolution, and this is only about a year ago I'm talking, this is not ancient history, trying to resolve this treaty from 1871, the court said this: we have no reason to believe that the Crown will not fulfill its promises to Treaty 1 nations. Well, the fact that it hasn't since 1871, I think, is a good reason. The Crown continues to stall on this. So that's treaty number 1. And then through the years of about a 40-year period, numerous treaties were signed. Mine is Treaty 5, Kiara's is Treaty 6, different areas of Canada. And treaty number 11, which is in the northern part of Canada, was considered a fraudulent document. So it was just thrown out. That's Canada's history with the numbered treaties. And then we enter into this period. Yeah, we enter into this period of modern treaties. So with treaty number 11 being thrown out, because they weren't even sure who signed it or who negotiated it. It was that bad. We end up with this thing called comprehensive claims. So if you were to look at a map of Canada and see where the numbered treaties sit, you'll see a large portion of the territory that has no treaty. Exactly. Viv's pulling up a map here. So Google that and have a look. You'll see in the West Coast, there's a lot of area not covered by treaty. In the East Coast, there's a lot of land not covered. And out of those, in large part because of your Mabo case, we recognize underlying native title. In those areas where there was no treaty, the peoples, the nations there have come forward and said, you have no right to own this land, and trapped them with their own words and said, you now are required to treat with us. And we come up with modern treaties like the NISGA agreement, where it grants sort of a title to the NISGA nation. It gives them a lot more self-determination. But even in recent jurisprudence, in the Silcoteen case in 2014, this is the first time in Canada when a specific group of people have claimed title to a specific piece of land and it's been recognized by law. So they have veto over any development or pipelines or mining, resource management. It's up to that group, up to the Silcoteen Nation. So we see these three periods in Canadian history where we've gone from treaties that were easily ignored and forgotten to the modern treaties that are these inch or two-inch thick books that are contracts, legal contracts, and we call them treaties. So we have all sorts of experience with treaties, but not necessarily good experience.
So there was the other part of that, they could trade and they could also bring God. Did you see any part of that, other part of the equation? Did you ever see God over there? You know, because that was the promise here too. Yeah, they were going to come and civilize us and Christianize
IRS.
Us.
Yeah, Indian residential school, so very similar to missions and Stolen Generation. Missions are more like reserves were set up. At the same time, we were signing treaty in 1876. They had passed this thing called the Indian Act, which covers everything from the birth of a person to the death of a person, and everything in between is regulated by the state. And that was supposed to bring God, but it just brought bureaucrats and brought priests that didn't do great things in community or to kids in residential school. So we've just come out of a five-year inquiry in residential schools called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Its report 2 years ago with 94 recommendations.
Calls to action.
Calls to action. There we go.
How many recommendations?
94 calls to action. So,
okay. Covering everything from elementary school curriculum to mandatory education for law school students to changes in healthcare. It's a comprehensive report saying, here's the damage that Indian residential schools did, and here's what needs to be done to set it right.
I just mentioned that because of I think of the 395 recommendations that came out of the Royal Commission to Deaths in Custody, which I don't think they touched on many of them.
Yeah.
You know, and that was nearly 30 years ago. What sort of weight do you put in commissions of inquiry, and what's the involvement of First Nations in these commissions?
Well, we 25 years ago had the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People.
1996.
And we haven't seen a lot come out of there. There was over 3,000 page report with so many recommendations that we could be lost in the book of recommendations. But the government basically shelved it. There was nothing. Nothing really came out of that for communities or for changes in government, are my thoughts. And now the TRC report, I think that something's actually starting to change a bit, because Canadians are kind of waking up a bit, or at least a few Canadians are waking up. And there's a lot of the universities are all talking great big talk about transforming and reconciliation. Every province is talking about transforming and reconciliation. But, you know, we've heard these tunes before.
Yes, I was just going
and
to say that.
So often they're just empty words. And, you know, this whole bit on reconciliation, you guys have gone through 25 years of this. Yeah. What is reconciliation and other than, you know, they want us to assimilate?
Yes, that's Myra and Kira, who were, I suppose you call them treaty experts from Manitoba in Canada, who actually witnessed the very first treaty forum here in Melbourne just a couple of years ago. And, you know, their thoughts were, you know, quite profound. I thought that was very empty. Anyway, in the near future, we're going to have an interview with Irene Watson, who is spent the last 40 years looking at Aboriginal law and international conventional law. So stay tuned for ECR Community Radio.
Hello, this is Dan Sultan, and you're listening to 3CR Blackfella Radio, Melbourne.
My grandma told me all about the things that happened here when white men came into this land, or blacks lived in fear. Not all the whites were bad to them, but there are quite a few. The terrible things they did to them was red, white and blue. They took young girls away on boats and made them work for naught, and sometimes the soldiers and settlers would kill the blacks for sport. Now here on mainland Tassie, where the fighting got so bad, to think of all the killings really makes me sad. That was genocide for sure.
In 1944, Polish-Jewish lawyer Raphael Lemkin coined the term genocide by combining geno from the Greek word for race or tribe with sede from the Latin word for killing. Lemkin defined genocide as a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. This is Raphael Lemkin explaining what drove his work on genocide.
Became interested in genocide because it happened so many times. It happened to the Armenians, and after the Armenians, Hitler took action.
Lemkin became the leading force behind the drafting and adoption on the International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, adopted unanimously by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December the 9th, 1948.
I would urge, and I think that's the spirit, the unanimous view of the Assembly, that this convention be signed by all states, ratified by all parliaments at the earliest date, in order that basic human rights be given the protection of international law for the sake of progress, social and international peace.
The contracting parties, having considered the declaration made by the General Assembly of the United Nations in its resolution that genocide is a crime under international law, contrary to the spirit and aims of the United Nations and condemned by the civilised world, recognising that at all periods of history, genocide has inflicted great losses on humanity, and being convinced, and in order to liberate mankind from such an odious scourge, international cooperation is required. Australia was one of the first to ratify the Genocide Treaty on July the 8th, 1949. The CPPG is made up of 19 articles. These are the first five.
Look, we might come back to those articles in a second because we do have Irene Watson on the line right here.
Good morning, Irene. Thanks for coming on 3CR Community Radio. How you been?
Hello. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolutely. So could tell us how you've been going and what you've been doing over the last 40 years, I suspect, looking at Aboriginal law and international legal conventions and how it applies to Australia. As you know, it's the 70th anniversary of the Genocide Convention and Human Rights Charter today.
Yeah.
And just want to get your thoughts about what's Australia's position on all of this.
Well, I think there's lots to think about, isn't there? and we probably won't cover it all, but what's Australia's position? I think Australia's position on this, like everything else, is pretty much we can take it right back to terra nullius, you know, but where, you know, the founding principle of the Australian state, terra nullius, Aboriginal peoples didn't exist, and if we did exist, we existed lesser than, you know, any other members of the human race. And I don't think, well, I don't believe that we have moved on from that position at all. We might have moved on in terms of the language and the rhetoric of recognition, but in fact, and going back to your point about genocide, the laws, the international laws of genocide don't apply to Aboriginal people's situation. So in a sense, there's a direct line back to terra nullius. There's no, or very, very difficult, as you know yourself, Robbie, and many of us know from the application that was made in the 90s, you know, arising out of Native Title and the amendments to the Native Title Act and the action that was taken there, constructing that those amendments and the whole history that led us to that point were acts of genocide against Aboriginal peoples, was that the finding of the court, and as it went to the High Court, who wouldn't even hear it, did they? They wasn't an application that they would give leave to hear. That the crime of genocide did not apply to Australia.
Just on that, Senator Brian Gregg from the Democrats in 1999 put up an anti-genocide bill. Mm. Do you know what happened to that at the end of the day?
Yeah, good point. You know, some of us made submissions. I think it got lost in the business of everyone being too busy or not having any priority. Yeah, not exactly, but I think that's what happened. It just vanished, really.
I just recently noticed that there was a notice saying that it was not proceeding. This is 2018. I'm just wondering what the status of that act is at the present time. And I don't think many people realise that. Well, I'm saying that they haven't got a genocide convention here. That means there's no prevention and no punishment for it.
Yeah, that's
despite
right.
The federal court saying that it did occur here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, as you know, you're involved in that matter. Justice Crispin said, even though on fact he found and that there was numerous accounts and that there was clear evidence of genocide against Aboriginal peoples, but he had no jurisdiction and couldn't proceed because there was no crime of genocide recognised in Australian law. So whilst the Australia supports the International Convention on genocide, of it being a crime, it has no application to the position of Aboriginal peoples of Australia.
Hi, Irene, it's Viv here. Just what you said there, isn't Article 5 of the Convention, Australia is in clear breach, as I understand? They were given time to come and legislate and make it, you know, illegal here. That was the expectation.
You're talking about the one on assimilation.
Article 5 where the one it says...
Removing children?
No. I could be wrong with the number, but where it says that they... Now go back to your countries and you're given some time to make it law there.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I should have it.
That'd be the Ratification Act.
Right in front of me. But if we were to talk about the forcible, there's an article in the convention that says that the forcible, and this has been raised over and over again, the forcible removal of children from a particular group of peoples is a crime of genocide. And clearly that was also raised by Commissioner Wilson, the commissioner of the 1990s Stolen Generation Report.
Ron Wilson,
yes. Yeah, who said that, again, you know, that there was evidence of the forcible removal of Aboriginal children constituted a crime of genocide, that was also sort of, you know, slapped down and banished and disappeared. And comparative to, you know, the in Canada, another scholar, Tamara Starblank, has just recently written a book called Suffer the Little Children, who gives a really clear account of the removal of Aboriginal children from their families, not dissimilar to what happened here in Australia, and the reasons why this is never ever sort of surfaced within the jurisdiction of Canada and also within Australia as constituting a crime of genocide. So that to me is really the illogic of how illogical the law is in this area, that while we have clear evidence of the forcible removal, it aligns with the Genocide Convention itself. Getting that point up and heard and bringing it before the jurisdiction of any of the Australian courts is highly problematic. And further to that, it's also difficult with the, you know, people will say, well, what about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? Well, the very reason why Aboriginal people explored the UN as a possible remedy was because we were getting no traction on the ground here in Australia within domestic law. And a lot of the work, the early work that was done in the UN in drafting the declaration, I know because I was involved in a few of those sessions, was largely the drafting of minimum standards, and the purpose and the reason behind the drafting of the minimum standards in the declaration was for the very purpose and reason to prevent the ongoing genocide of Aboriginal peoples. Now, that was an account that was given by the majority of Aboriginal people who were going there, not as representatives of the states, because remember, we have also had a number of Aboriginal people who've been involved in the UN who in my view, are not representative of the Aboriginal nations. They've been funded by the states to attend, but largely on the ground at that grassroots representation of our nations, the aim was to prevent the genocide. So that really does tell you something about the what's happening domestically and internationally, that we are really don't have clear remedies in international law for the prevention of genocide of Aboriginal peoples and the ongoing colonialism. And that really says something about the effect of the UN Genocide Convention, the effect of it being completely ineffective, or the impossibility of Aboriginal peoples internationally and here at home being able to use it as a remedy to stop the various actions of genocide, which, you know, as I said, is the forcible removal of Aboriginal children, the
deaths in custody.
And if the convention had have been broadened to include cultural genocide, so when Lemkin, Raphael Lemkin, who was the drafter of the convention, one of the drafters, the most recognised drafter, formulated the convention in the 1940s, there was reference to cultural genocide, but that was removed, and it was removed specifically to ensure that the convention didn't apply to colonised people, to Aboriginal peoples who'd been colonised and who can continue to be colonised today. So it was intentionally removed to ensure that it was limited to not cover our
yes, that's as I understand. Irene, could you explain what this state, this assumed authority, what they tell the United Nations and the Northern Hemisphere, who sort of don't seem to really see what's going on here, what do they tell them for the last 70 years that appeases them? I heard someone in the UN from representing Australia saying how heinous a crime genocide is because they're marking the 70th anniversary. Mm. So what's the tale they're telling them?
Well, I guess that's the problem, is who's representing, who represents our position, and that's highly problematic. The Australian state is obviously going to airbrush out any information or detail about acts of genocide and the situation of the forcible removal of children, amongst other evidence that we would argue constitutes genocide. So, I mean, I think that's the problem, though, is how our voices are being represented, how our experiences are being represented. We're largely, I'd say we're not being represented, that the Aboriginal view is not being represented, because it's been put by the voices that are heard are those by the state. And, you know, we may say we have some Aboriginal representation, but the fact is that the Aboriginal representation that is the voice within the UN are people who've been appointed by the Australian government.
All right, just thinking of
the two Aboriginal positions on the UN Permanent Forum and the UN Expert Mechanism have been appointed by the Australian government.
There you go. I'm just thinking of the whole thing.
And I'm not making any personal attack on those individuals, but it's a fact. If you're appointed by the government, then you're going to represent the government. So there's a clear conflict. And I think that one of the problems for us is that the UN body has not properly dealt with those.
Are they conspiring? Are they collaborating in Australia's experience here?
Well, we could say all of that, the point I'm making is that the UN has rules about conflicts of interest, and my question to the UN is, why aren't they considering these conflicts as they arise and apply to Aboriginal people?
The United Nations Convention was to prevent and punish prevention. Now, it seems very clear to me that Australia has failed to prevent. I know they haven't punished anybody.
Yes.
So they're clearly in breach of the Act. And you know, one of the things that came out of the Nuremberg trials was evil reigns when good people do nothing. So what does that say about this country here?
Well, it applies, doesn't it?
So where do we go from here? You know, what do we do? What's the next step on this?
We just keep on telling the truth. You know, we can't abandon and I'm not going to use the word hope. I have been using the word hope, and it's a late. I think that we need to go into our languages and find what that word is. And in my view, it's about, we have an obligation to the future, and it's looking to the future and taking responsibility for our own Aboriginal futures, and that we have one, and that also for our young people that are being born, that we're able to pass on that ethic of an Aboriginal future, that we've been here forever and we have managed this country, this continent, all of the nations together have managed this place forever, and we will be here forever. And I guess I want to see us. And I'm not going to demean that and say it's rhetoric. It's an ethic. It's an Aboriginal ethic. It's what's been passed on to us, and what we'll pass on. So, I'm in our thinking and in our doing, in our acting, that we continue to hold ground, and do that, and hold the authority, and the rest is as it has been for the 250 years is just an ongoing struggle to stand our ground in light of the fact that the Australian state is an illegitimate colonial construct. And I'd have to say that international law and the UN is also itself a construct of colonialism.
Yes.
It came out of colonialism. So therein lay the problem, and we keep going to the state and we go to the UN for a remedy against colonialism. So the remedy really is in everyone coming to the truth of the Australian state, acknowledging its very own colonial character, and also the UN, and So there's not a practical ready-made solution, but I think that the truth is a good place to start.
Absolutely.
Because we're just feeding some kind of, you know, the illusion of recognition is problematic. I mean, it's highly problematic for us to go and seek recognition from the Australian state and from the UN. And I say that as a lawyer looking at the future. But in the meanwhile, for all of us who have families and have lives in the day-to-day, we're in a space where we're negotiating peace, you know, and I think we have an obligation to keep doing that work because
Irene, I just want to add to that, like, you know, we owe this obligation to our children to bring them into a safe place. And also we need to acknowledge our ancestors and our elders who died in the process and people who continue to die in an, you know, as an act of genocide that's going on here. So that needs to be acknowledged too. Australia's never got consent, has no jurisdiction, and got this whole litany of human rights crimes against our people and their own. So it's in the interest of all people that, that these sort of heinous crimes are dealt with immediately, like the same urgency as when the Nazi Germany was in control of the place.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just, it's 70 years on now from the Genocide Convention when the Liberal Party first came to power, the Menzies government, and they had the responsibility of ratifying and legislating. Obviously went in the too hard basket. And I'm just wondering what happened in 99 when Senator Brian Gregg put it up again, and it's still not adhered to. So, I think it's just, like you say, we've just got to keep marching on, and sooner or later this will become reality, that it'll be a genocide-free country that we're in if we keep going and keep fighting for what's right.
It's problematic. We're seeking a remedy against genocide from the perpetrators,
yes,
from the state and from the UN, and that's the position. We also have an obligation to try and keep the peace in our own lives, and
it's like
and
a
our nation. So it's we're in a very 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 it's precarious. It's always been precarious from the time of Cook's Landing. It's been, it's been precarious. It's not much has changed. Nothing has improved. It's getting worse because we're also suffering the ongoing degradation of our lands, which we're all connected to.
Incarceration rates of our people.
That it's improving. I can't see the improvement. I think it's worsening, and not only worsening, it's worsening for everyone on the planet. So,
just the final throes of colonialism on its way out, and they're just desperate and prepared to do anything in response to maintaining their status quo.
So I think that without, you know, simplifying, I think that the future is in the future is for all of us is to decolonize and not to throw that out as rhetoric, but as one where people understand the depth of colonialism, that the Australian state is a colonial state, that the UN that we're appealing to is a collaboration of colonizing states, and that it is these institutions that need to decolonize. We just need to continue being ourselves and managing the country as we have been for forever. It's the colonial mechanisms that need to unpack themselves, and that's where I see the work needs to be done. Is it impossible? Probably, but the future becomes impossible if this work doesn't get done.
Irene, I want to sincerely thank you for coming on the show this morning. And for listeners out there, I want to perhaps talk a little bit about, you know, you've got an extensive history and understanding here. You know what you're talking about. And you also hear, is it true you are the first Aboriginal law graduate of the time when that happened?
Well, in Adelaide.
That's
pretty significant.
Yeah. Thank you for all your work too, because a lot of it's available online. I've done a lot, and you're using that information to, you know, tell us the truth. As I said, I'm 100% aligned with everything you say. And thank you so much for your time.
Me too, Irene, and I really appreciate you coming on here. I know you're busy and you've just been travelling.
We're all busy.
We are that.
All of our old people are busy keeping their families and communities together. I'm no more busy. We're all on the same boat. So, look, thank you both. I know you two are busy too. I appreciate the work you do with the program. So thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. I won't say anything about hope, but we had a lot of faith in people like yourself, Irene, and, you know, we got... With people like you, we can put this back out in an informed way back at these colonising states and the United Nations included. If we haven't got people like you, we've been in deep trouble. So thank you very much again. And hope to catch up soon.
Okay, have a nice day, you too.
Thank you so much.
Bye for now.
You're listening to 3CR Radio.
Yes, and that was Irene Watson, who was an experienced, activist in the area of law, and particularly international law and how it applies to this country. So I want to say thank you again to Irene.
All right, we're going to play we're going to just go through a bit of the convention, just the first five articles. Here they are.
Article 1. The contracting parties confirm that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law, which they undertake to prevent and to punish. Article 2. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts: committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial or religious group, such as A. killing members of the group, B. causing serious bodily or mental harm to the members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Article 3. The following acts shall be punishable. A. Genocide. B. Conspiracy to commit genocide. C. Direct and public incitement to commit genocide. D. Attempt to commit genocide. E. Complicity in genocide. Article 4. Persons committing genocide or any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3 shall be punished, whether they are constitutionally responsible rulers, public officials, or private individuals. Article 5. The contracting parties undertake to enact, in accordance with their respective constitutions, the necessary legislation to give effect to the provisions of the present convention, and in particular, to provide effective penalties for persons guilty of genocide or of any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3.
We jail black males in Australia nationally at a rate five times greater than apartheid South Africa jailed black males in 1993. The suicide and self-harm rates are the highest in the world, and the life expectancy gap is the biggest in the first world. You know, Australians don't like hearing the truth about how bad things are, but the more we resolve from it, the longer this is going to continue.
Black fella, white fella, it doesn't matter what you colour.
Mainstream media is not interested in this stuff. It doesn't find space to talk truthfully and deeply about issues that affect all Australians. The only place predominantly you will find that with any real depth is on community radio, and 3CR has been one of the great leaders in that. So if people are wondering where they should spend their hard-earned cash, I would suggest 3CR is a bloody good place to start.
What your name is, we got the hand. Lots of changes, we need more brothers.
To whom it may concern, my name is Talgum of the Tunnerung. I plead no jurisdiction, and there are no documents of consent from any of my people without duress or undue influence to justify the illegal occupation of my land and the usurpation of my law, L-A-W-L-O-R. My people have never ceded our sovereignty or law, as is my human right. I live under my people's sovereignty and law and come under our jurisdiction. Until you can show me documents of consent from my people, my land is stolen. That is grand theft. Under Terra Nullius, which was thrown out of the Mabo case in 1992 as a lie of unutterable shame, to this day our sovereignty and law are still not recognised. Yet, as I have stated, we have never ceded it. Even under the illegal constitution, it states religious freedom under section 116. As my law is my religion, you cannot prohibit my religious freedom, and I don't have to specify what my religion is. For these reasons, I plead no jurisdiction, and I wish to be dealt with by my people of the Kulin Nation, where this court presides. It is an act of genocide to deny me this human right, and it causes me severe mental harm to be tried by the system that has stolen my land and continues to commit genocide on my people. Thank you in good faith, Taljum of the Tanarung.
Welcome back to the Black Bloc here on the 70th anniversary of human rights, apparently.
Human rights and the Genocide Convention.
Yes. Yeah. Yesterday.
Extremely yeah. important acts. On the line now we have LaToya Rule.
Hi.
We got you.
How are you?
Hello, sis. Welcome to the show. We're talking human rights as usual. Tell us what's been happening. What are you doing down here?
What are you doing today?
So I've come over for the weekend from Ghana country, which is in Adelaide where I'm from. I'm a Wiradjuri Māori woman, but I've resided on, Ghana country my whole life. So shout out for them.
Yes. We just had Irene Watson from Ghana country.
And I've come over, this weekend for the Uncle Ray Jackson memorial poster launch that happened.
Yes.
And that was yesterday, where, like Gary Foley and a few others had some words there about Uncle Ray Jackson's life. And then on Saturday that was as well. So, we're kind of celebrating and remembering our warriors. And also for myself, my brother's, his name was Wayne Feller Morrison. He passed in custody just over 2 years ago. And we're going through the coroner's proceedings. So I came to speak about that and yesterday memorialising our people who have passed in custody as Aboriginal deaths in custody. And so today for International Human Rights Day, we're going to be at Bourke Street Mall at 1 p.m. And alongside our allies and our mob, we're going to be holding up the faces and the names and the stories of our people who have passed in custody and, making sure that people remember these people.
Can you just reiterate that, the time and the place exactly where that's going to take place?
Yep, 1 p.m. Yep. At Bourke Street Mall in Melbourne.
Okay, so that's about an hour away. And we'd encourage all of our mob to support that. And as many non-Aboriginal people who see this as a pretty fundamental crime against our people continuing here, and to come and support us down there today. As we're saying, it's the 70th anniversary of the Human Rights Charter, the creation of the United Nations. But none of these laws seem to apply to us here. And just recently, we've had a very similar case to your brother, Warren, with a lady by the name of Tanya. We had no clue about what happened, and it's been nearly 2 years since she passed. It's just come out now that it's considered to be a death in custody, and we had no idea that that happened. What's the circumstances of your brother?
Yeah, it's not unusual to not be told. We weren't told for a few hours after the incident occurred in Yatala Prison in Adelaide. And essentially he was 6 days on remand, no convictions, no prior history of police contact. He was 29 years old. He has a young daughter. And he was in there on remand, and there was apparently an altercation that occurred, and then he was restrained by over 14 corrections officers, had a spit hood, had his arms tied behind his back and his legs tied, And then he was put in the back of a transport van with seven corrections officers. Now, when 3 minutes later, when he was pulled out, he was dead for 50 minutes. And then for 3 days following, he was on intensive care. And so his story, it took 2 years. We're only going through the coroner's court just now. And unfortunately, I don't know if people have seen in the media, particularly on The Guardian's reporting, but the corrections officers and their lawyers are actually saying that we're trying to fight that they don't have to witness or give statements or show up in court, in the coroner's court, because it might criminalise them. So there's a human right, which is why it's just kind of funny that it's International Human Rights Day, There's a human right that's actually protecting these corrections officers from coming into that court and giving evidence about the final moments of Wayne's life, and how we as a family, I guess, we don't have that right to say that, we don't have the right to know.
And does any people have the right to say that I won't be answering any questions because it may incriminate me? What's the idea of a court and an inquiry in the first place, if you can say that?
That's right. Coroner's courts are supposed to be about, truth-telling.
Answering questions.
Yeah, and what happened? For our family, for corrections, even for their own betterment. I mean, I'm a prison abolitionist, but when you look at their policies, they're always saying they want to do better. And here they are avoiding showing up in the first instance. It's also a big spit in the face, not only to our human rights, but to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Death and Custody that really pushed this aspect of coronial investigations, although they're state-run, really pushed it for transparency and accountability purposes.
Millions of dollars were spent in these Royal Commissions of inquiry. Nothing ever seems to happen. What happened to the 300 recommendations? That doesn't seem to apply. It's just a stalling tactic. The real intent is to... Obviously, the real intent here is to continue to commit genocide. It's so obvious. And I think Australia is so glaringly guilty. They've failed to prevent or punish anyone in regards to that crime alone. And where's the human rights laws in this country today? I'm not really aware of where that's at, but it seems they don't apply to our people.
No, look, I'm all about, to be honest, nation building and looking at our own ways of collaborating with other nations across Australia, so-called Australia, and actually just, building a revolution against these things. Because I explained yesterday, and it might sound really severe, but I've been listening to a little bit of Malcolm X lately and the way he speaks about revolution, because I feel very like we're getting there with all the police brutality, with all the correctional violence against our people, and we've been here before, but I really feel like it's coming on. And I looked at the faces of the Aboriginal people who have passed in custody, and all of their blood has been spilled. And as Malcolm X says, every revolution has been about land, and it's been a bloody battle. And
absolutely.
So I look at all the blood that's been spilled of our people, and then I look at what we're doing in response, and we're very lenient. We've been very lenient.
That's just the nature of our people. We're human.
Yeah.
And, none of these protection. I'm just thinking about the Protection Act of Aboriginal People. It was another act of genocide to our people. Put us in concentration camps. That was their idea of protecting us.
Yeah.
And, the worst thing you could possibly do is get protection from this state.
That's so, right. And with these, drug and alcohol, and particularly, a shout out and give my respects to Tanya's family and other families who have gone under the Liquor Licensing Act and, who have been picked up due to alcoholism or what they say, or drunkenness and, in public. But, to be honest, prisons are being seen, and holding cells have always been seen as sobering up units. And as a social worker, I know that, particularly the one on Kaurna Country in Adelaide, the sobering up unit, police take people there all the time. But then they come back into the cells once they've sobered up. So cells are actually being seen as a positive way to sober someone up, but that's where they die.
There's the issue of jurisdiction and all of that as well. What right have they actually got to judge and try our people and incarcerate us when they haven't got,
consent and
jurisdiction over us? Latoya, we've got someone else on the line. Is that right, Viv?
I will.
To mention that down in Bourke Street today at 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Yeah, we'll see you there, sis.
We'll see, try and get there. And also on Wednesday, I've got my program, so if you want to come back on Friday, we've got a Brian Gregg, who actually put up the anti-genocide convention back in 1999, coming on the air. So sorry to wind you up like that, but you know,
thank you.
Appreciate you coming on.
And go process, and I'll see you all down there.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be there for
thank
sure.
You. Thanks.
All right, love you.
See love you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was LaToya
Rule. Whose brother passed away in custody a couple of years ago, very similar circumstances to lots of our people. You know, we don't even get to hear what happened at the time. You know, we find out days later, and in Tanya's case, years later.
All right, I'm going to play a short song. You're listening to The Black Bloc here on the 70th anniversary of human rights as coined in the United Nations. Stay tuned.
You listen to The Black Bloc on 3CR Community Radio, and we've got a special guest on it on the line, none other than former Senator Brian Gregg, who put the anti-genocide bill up in 1999. Good morning, Brian. How you going, mate? Thanks for coming on.
Good morning, and hello to everyone in Victoria.
And in the studio, we have Viv Malo.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. We really appreciate your time here. What we wanted, while we invited you on, was just could you please tell the story about introducing the anti-genocide bill in 99? What was your motivation? How did you become aware that it wasn't yet part of domestic law? And, yeah, just tell us the story, please.
Well, it's interesting, I suppose. There were two factors. I was a senator with the Australian Democrats, and I suppose a lot of your listeners would remember the Australian Democrats. It was what, it was a minor party, but back in the...
Yeah, we remember, brother. Late,
well, of course, as I get older, because I'm now 53, when I was in the Senate, I went in at 33, so I was a very young senator. And the Australian Democrats in those days were very well known, and at the time we had 9 senators, so quite a significant force on the cross benches. Yep. But a lot of young people these days don't know that the Australian Democrats, because they don't exist now, and they're fading away in the memory of younger people. And a lot of new minor and micro parties have sort of replaced that space. But when you're a minor party, you're always looking for issues that aren't being addressed by the major parties. That's your strength, and in a sense, that's kind of your duty. And so as the Australian Democrat spokesperson for Attorney General's and Justice and Customs issues, I was looking around for something to get my teeth into that went beyond the day-to-day work of the Senate and the day-to-day work of the legislation coming at me from the Howard government. And this one kind of caught my eye, mostly because one of the things that happens when you're an MP or a senator is that you get asked, you don't have to do it, but you get asked by the parliamentary system if each year, particularly in the new year, if you'll take on an intern. There are lots of keen young people, particularly those studying law or studying political sciences, who are really, really keen to get a few weeks' work, volunteer work, working for an MP. And they come and sit in your office and help out. And there's often not a great deal they can do. A lot of MPs won't take them on because they sort of get under your feet more than anything else. But if you're prepared to give them a go and give them something to do, then they can be really valuable. And most often what they like to do, if they have a particular area of interest, is get to work on putting a bill together, a private member's bill, particularly if they have a passion around something. And I took on, over the 6 years I was in federal parliament, I took on, I think, 4 or 5 interns. And one year I had a wonderful young woman who was studying law come to work for me called Claire Vinnicum. And Claire had a particular interest in this. And she put it to me, and I was a bit bewildered because at the time I didn't know that Australia was so far behind in this area. I didn't know that Australia was not a signatory to the convention and there were no particular laws against genocide in this country. And she said, well, there isn't. And she sort of talked me through it. And she said, wouldn't it be great if we could get some debate going around this? And I said, sure, okay, go for it. So the kudos for this really rests with Claire. So she put it together, and she put the bill together, and kind of by by accident and coincidence, around about the same time, we started to get some quite solid news stories around Australia, and some in Melbourne for that matter, of Nazi war criminals coming to the fore. Conrad Kollege was one that came to mind, who was discovered living in Australia, and it was alleged that he was a former Nazi war criminal and hadn't come to justice anywhere in the world and was living comfortably in Australia. He was then in his late 80s, early 90s. There were some others. It was also known that there were some former war criminals from Cambodia also living comfortably in Australia. And one of the things we did once we produced the bill and tabled it in Parliament is we held an inquiry through the Senate's Legal and Constitutional References Committee, and we took some public hearings and had an inquiry into the strength and weaknesses of the bill as people and legal organisations saw it, and that generated quite a bit of debate and wider discussion around it. So that's really where that came from.
So, that's right. I was part of a group of people who actually tried to charge the Commonwealth with the crime of genocide back in 97. It was Howard. Mm-hmm. Howard was in government with Nulurima, Buzzacott, Thorpe. And we were told that genocide's not a crime in Australia. There just wasn't any legislation. You know, which I thought was pretty weird because, my understanding of the UN Convention was that it had universal jurisdiction, no one was immune and had no statutory limitations. And we got to the point where there was an admission by the federal court that genocide had actually happened, but we was told we had to prove the intent, which I thought was strange again. And your bill was put up at that time, 1999, and just wondering what happened to the process since then. I thought, well, they've got this domestic version of this international law. I suppose that's something. But I just looked recently and said that the bill was not proceeding in 2018. So I'm just wanted to get your thoughts about that, and mainly that point.
Well, there are literally hundreds of private members' bills which are introduced over any term of government. Most terms of government are about 3 years. But, of course, no bill can proceed unless it has the numbers. You know, politics is all about numbers.
Okay.
And governments, as we've seen from Scott Morrison in recent days, governments are all paranoid and controlled by numbers. And no piece of legislation can proceed unless it has the numbers. So you can't even bring on a bill for debate, let alone pass it, unless you have the numbers. And for whatever reason, the Parliament of Australia has never had the gumption or the courage or the will to bring forward that bill or any similar piece of legislation. And I think you're right. I think you've touched on it. I think the great sensitivity or the great concern, lack of will, and the great cultural fear is how this issue touches on our past, touches on our own past, and triggers those debates around the country, around how our history intersects with Indigenous history and the intersection of genocide through our own history.
I'm just thinking on that point. If they consider how that affects their past, well, how's not having a genocide convention going to affect their future? I think that's an important issue there. And if they don't want this sort of protection for their people in the country, not just Aboriginal people, but their own people as well, that makes them subject down the track to the same happening to them. So that's the whole idea of prevention and punishment for the crime in the first place, is to make sure it never happens again. And so fundamental a law that's not part of the Australian legal landscape still today. It's pretty extraordinary situation. And I just wanted to ask you, what was the reaction of the Parliament at the time when you put that bill up?
Well, Parliament didn't really care because it knew that the bill was not going to go anywhere. 99% of private members' bills never go anywhere. That's just the nature of them. You know, as I say, governments control bills with the numbers that they have. The governments decide which bills pass and which they don't. Of course, we've seen in very recent days how that can fail, and how Scott Morrison shut down the parliament just late last week.
Yes.
When he realised he didn't have the numbers on this... I'm just trying to think of what the legislation
was.
Was it the encryption legislation?
Yes. Well, they got that through, encryption. Actually. What was the other one?
That's right.
Oh, yes. They were fearing that the other piece of legislation would show them up.
But you can see what I'm getting at, though. With the government being so uncertain about the fragility of its numbers in the lower house, particularly with the large, unstable crossbench, you know, governments will do anything they can to prevent losing face.
I'm just thinking how that would have applied to Nazi Germany back in 1945 if Hitler said, oh, we haven't got the numbers to pass this law. And so we're not going to have that that genocide punishment and prevention regime. I wonder if he had said that. But it was an intervention by the world on Nazi Germany. And I can't understand why there isn't an intervention in Australia in the same context.
Well, don't forget that Hitler didn't stop at burning down the parliament. Remember, he burnt down the Reichstag.
Okay. I wasn't totally aware of that, but he attempted to avoid that issue, I'm pretty sure.
He burnt it down and then blamed it on his enemies, so that's where that leads to.
Yeah.
But of course, look, Australia is not unusual in being deficient in core legislation. Remember, we are the only Western democracy and modern country that doesn't have a bill or a charter of rights of any description,
or a treaty,
or a treaty with its indigenous peoples, for that matter. And and it's quite startling to me that even the Australian Labor Party, which is a modern democratic socialist party, is still so incredibly weak in these areas. As opposed to Labor parties in, say, Canada or Britain, or for that matter, New Zealand, our near neighbours in New Zealand, which are so much more advanced.
Yes, absolutely. Where do we go from here now, you think, Brian? It seems like they're not going to ever legislate against the crime of genocide in Australia. I think it would sink them.
How can others have human rights if this most basic international law is not upheld? Yeah.
Look, I think it's fair to say that within 6 months' time, Australia will be governed by Bill Shorten and a Labor government, and I think it's probably fair to say that they'll be there for at least two terms. On current polling, the Australian Labor Party is 10 points ahead on a two-party preferred basis. That means Scott Morrison and the coalition is looking at losing at least 20 seats. So that, the Labor Party is heading into a comfortable victory with a solid majority of 20 seats, and that'll give them, 8 years of government stretching out in front of them. So I think that means there are opportunities there for, people and people and progressive organisations through the union movements and others to say, okay, let's do something. You've got a thumping majority, a strong mandate. A lot of progressive MPs. Let's actually do something. There's no point in having power if you're not going to use it. And I think Australians have shown, putting my other hat on, because I was very strongly involved in, LGBTI issues over the last 30 years.
Yep.
Australians have shown through the marriage equality debate and the postal survey that they are much more progressive and much more forward-thinking than our parliament and our political representatives. And I think they are much more sympathetic on these issues than our parliament expresses. And I think the Labor Party needs to catch up with that.
Yeah.
So is there any chance of someone else putting that bill up again and having writing it like that situation was how they won that?
Well, that specific bill, each time an election is called, parliament is prorogued, that's the technical term for it, prorogued, which basically means falls off a cliff, it ends. So every bill which is on the notice paper, including private members' bills, they all die, they all stop. So somebody could pick that up and dust it off and reintroduce it under their name and it becomes a fresh bill. Sure, you could do that. But what would be much more likely is somebody could pick it up and maybe tweak it a bit, maybe make a few changes, have a fresh look at it. It's now 20 years old, you know, or thereabouts. Have a fresh look. There might be some recent advances. There may be some new legal changes in comparable jurisdictions people might want to have a look at. There may be some things that we didn't think of including. But, you know, someone can pick up where I left off. You know, it could be done by a minor party. It could be done by an individual. Ideally, it should be done from someone from, I was going to say from the government, but that's not actually true. Ideally, it should be done as a cross-party bill. Ideally, you want a bill that has broad support across the chamber.
I think you're right.
Well, that's really good advice.
And I wonder...
Something to think about.
I wonder, in fact, if we might not see some more bills over the next 10 years that have cross-party support.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, why not? It's lots to think about. What you've just put out has really been awesome, and I want to thank you, Brian, and Claire Ridikin, who gave you the information that inspired you, and thank you for still talking about it. It's something we talk about a lot on here.
And, yes, really appreciate you coming on the air today, Brian, and I appreciate the work that you did do whilst you were a senator there, and hopefully next time. And I think I've got this belief that there's genocides connected to ecocide and, you know, the whole climate destruction, you know, what's happened to the custodians, the caretakers and the guardians of this land is what's causing the problems today. And if that law had been in place in 1949 when it was ratified by the Menzies government, it would have saved the stolen generations, the deaths in custody, the conditions of life, nearly all the problems that Aboriginal people face, the huge gap that we have here in this country today. So I just want to say thank you to you for explaining that to us, you know, what happened to your anti-genocide bill, and just to say thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Have a great day.
Enjoy the summer. Thanks. All right, you're still listening to 3CR Radical Radio, the Black Block, on the a Human Rights Special broadcast.
In this place, reality is far, and people forget who they are. They pick and they tease and put people down, just so it's not them wearing the frown. They forget where their families are, just so the pain seems to feel far. Here in these jail walls are harsh. Rules, standards and lines were made to march. Rules set by officers and inmates alike. If you don't conform, then take a hike. By screws to A2, by peers to yourself, I swear this place is a living hell. If you're different, then that's a disgrace. If you don't conform to standards, then that's out of place. So cruel, so sad, so naive, so permissive. Who are these people I'm living with? They can run, they can hide, but they cannot forget the things that led them to this house of regret. So my hope on this day for all my sisters inside is that they deal with their shit, then walk with pride.
Peace was yours, Australian man, with tribal laws you made, till white colonials stole your peace with rape and murder raid. They shot and poisoned and enslaved until a scattered few, only a remnant now remain, and the heart dies in you. The white man claimed your hunting grounds, and you could not remain. They made you work as menial for greedy private gain. Your tribes are broken vagrants now, wherever whites abide, and justice of the white man means justice to you denied. They bought you Bibles and disease, the liquor and the gun. With Christian culture such as these, the white command was won. A dying race, you linger on, degraded and oppressed. Outcasts in your own native land, you are the dispossessed.
people out there in the radio world, show some love to 3CR. You know, and if you're listening and enjoying the programs here, man, great radio station. It is how it was built by community and the community ownership, and that's a powerful thing to have within community. So show some love, show some support, and please subscribe.
From the north to the south, to the east, to the west, let the baller take you home. Island style, represent your soul to the flow. Love your set, represent. Raise your pride to the sky, love it like it's the best. My power, bring it back home.
The failure of the guardians of British justice to enforce basic British law means that the seizure of their land was and remains illegal.
Yes, and along with that also goes the destruction of our land. And as we heard, Raphael Lincoln, the man who coined the phrase genocide, wanted to have the issue of cultural genocide included into the Genocide Convention. And I've just had someone on the line, Zelenak, who I've lost your number, Zelenak. So can you ring us back straight away and talk to us about the issue of cultural destruction as a part of genocide and what you've been doing in the last 6 months or so? So sorry about that, bros, but if you can ring us back now, we'll get you on. Time is 12:41. You're listening to the Black Block on this Human Rights Day special.
All right, here's a song by Mitch Tembo.
Hi, my name is Lex Wharton, and I listen to 3CR, and I hope you do too. I hope that you could support 3CR in its radiothon, because 3CR supports the fight for communities and support in all areas of struggles. So please listen to 3CR.
Hey, time is 12:48. You listen to 3CR Community Radio. This is the Black Block, and we've got a special guest on the line, none other than Zelenak, a Gunai Yuin man. Gunai Samara as well. You on the line there, bros?
Yeah, hey, Nyata,
Deli, brother, thanks for coming on, hey. We've been talking about cultural destruction as a part of the genocide and how that relates to genocide. I know that you've been out there trying to defend the last vestiges of Aboriginal culture in this country, namely those sacred trees up there in Japwarong country recently. Give us a little bit of a take of what's been going on and what your feelings are about the destruction of culture in this state of Victoria.
My thing, the greatest thing that they could possibly destruct is the black mind and the black spirit. That's to me what they've done, not only to our land, but also to the mob now, you know, to the mindset of the mob, you know.
Yeah,
our mob are that scared to come out on country. Our mob are intimidated. Our mob get anxiety from it. Our mob pick every other choice but to go back out on land and fight for country. This is the decimation of what government's been able to and how they've been able to disempower the black revolution. You know, the black frontier war as such.
Continuing.
And what's been going on out here, the police harass us like every time we hit the road. Every time we hit the song lines, I should say, not the road.
Yeah.
Every time we hit the song lines, they always out there waiting for us.
Where are you now? Where are you camping now?
We're out at the sacred trees at the Japrong.
Okay.
Out here.
And how's that looking?
I heard there was a meeting over at Warrnambool the other day over at Gundij Country about native title and then also about. They were discussing some stuff about the trees, which I never got an invite to, but I did hear that they were directing Vic Roads back down the second route so we can go over and have a look at that, which on the 4th of, like, 3-4 months ago when we had a meeting up at Brambuck with Vic Roads, We directed them that we wanted to go down and have a look down the second route to see what cultural relevance is there, what cultural significance is there.
What sort of destruction is going to take place there.
Yeah, and the minute we find any cultural sensitivity, we're just going to shut it down and just say, you know what, at the end of the day, we'll have a look at the third route now. That's too culturally sensitive. We're not gonna accommodate for that of behaviour and that type of business any longer.
Yeah,
it's time that we conduct proper business. It's time that we conduct proper business in this country. And I'm talking about human rights commissions. I'm talking about truth-telling commissions. I'm talking about, we're going through treaty negotiations and all that in a not too long distance. And so the greatest thing I see happening, is not only our lands and all that have been taken away, but once you take away the direction of us and which way we want to go and following them ancestral trails, mate, we walk around soulless. I feel for our human right, for our mindset. At the end of the day, like, everything else is going to be taken away and we're going to be left with all that destruction, all that, every time I look at land, every time I look at country, I see fences,
I feel it too, brother. I hear what you're saying.
It just disheartens me. I cry out. And I really want for our mob, for all our mobs to come together so we can finally conduct our business. It's got nothing to do with no other nations around the world. This is ours. This is us. This is our time in our country.
Brother, you've been up on those trees there for a while now.
Yeah.
And I heard what happened to your missus yesterday.
Yeah, my wife. Yeah, they over stupid bullish fines. They had a warrant out for her arrest.
How people die over these fines?
Made her out to be a criminal. Was going to use brute force. Forced her pretty much into complying.
Yeah.
I pretty much put my body on the line and said, look, if you take her, you take me too. Plain and simple. If you touch her with force, well, at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're committing war on my homeland.
Exactly.
And you're committing war on my homeland, and I'll be forced to stand here and fight the war.
They've been getting away with it for a while, bros.
They have. They
have just decimated our people in the process, and I really appreciate your strength standing up there.
Our mob, I see half our mob very, very happy with themselves and very happy with the way organisations are going and the way everything is. I see mob very happy, but I also see mob that are like, hey, what about us, mob?
Which is the majority.
Did you forget about us, mob? You mob forget about us. What you mob just done for yourselves,
This corporation law is not the law of our people, bros, as we know.
Not all of our mob can assimilate. No. Not all of our mob can do that.
No. With a conscience.
Not all of our mob can do that. Lots of the mob do that, but not all of us can do that.
I think they're very weak on law business, though, as you can see what's happened with this this so-called protection of our heritage here. It's just been decimated since this cultural heritage legislation's come into play.
Our children can't be protected. Our lands can't be protected. What cultural sensitivity, what culturalness are these people doing? We're still fighting on the frontier war. We're still asking for jurisdiction while mob is still going out making partnerships and agreements with policemen.
Behind our back.
Behind our back, around domestic violence and all this kind of stuff.
That's all connected.
Let's be honest here. The domestic violence never come from us. The domestic violence come from them white wadjila fella, them perpetrator fella.
Yes, right.
Forcing that upon our families, smashing up our families, desecrating the mindsets of our families, ancestral roots, and look at the destruction. And then they want us to go to a job.
Exactly.
Want us to go to a job.
I can hear everything you're saying, man. Look, you're on the ground up there, defending the country. Put a call out, bros. I'm behind you 100%. That's my country too. Put a call out to the people.
I'm constantly putting calls out.
The conscientious non-Aboriginal Australians and the black folks who want to stand up for their country. This is a perfect opportunity. That bit of land up there is worth defending, like it all is, but this is a current issue. And I think if you put a call out now for the people to come and join you now, I think it'll go a long way, brother. So we've got 4 minutes of our program to go, so I want to sort of...
Hey, all of you mob out there listening, this is coming from the bottom of my heart. This is coming from my ancestors. This is coming from the spirit. This is coming from a place of of solidarity. I now call all you mob out there that are listening. If it irks you somewhere along the line, make the choice. Jump in the car, jump on the highway, jump on a train, jump on whatever you can get on to get up here and help us on the front line. We can't do it alone. It's not going to be done alone. We need all the support we can get. Christmas period's coming up, Wadjila Way, yeah? So yep. They're all going to be out and about. So we need to have our lands protected. We also need to have mob on the land. And so that hand in hand, spiritually, everything can come together. We can all come together. Finally, you mob. I really want you mob, please.
Can hear you,
I'm
bro.
I'm begging you, mob. Now's the time. We've got to take action.
I think you're right. This is the time. This is the time. And can you explain exactly where the location is again for us all?
Western Highway, on your way to Ararat, corner of Warriatkin Road.
And it's also right where the Hopkin River starts or begins, right, and it's a very special river for us, mob, all through the Western Districts here, the Hopkins River, yeah. So good on you, bros.
For those mob who can't make it out here, please keep your donations coming, keep your supplies coming, keep your support coming. It's all being appreciated. We appreciate it very much. It does get tough out here, but at the same time, I know what my responsibilities are. I know where they lie. I know where my priorities lie, and that's in fighting for this land, fighting for country, and hopefully showing the rest of my mob how to stand up and take action and take control of our own destinies in this country.
Yeah, I feel safer there, brother, with your authority on that bit of country than anywhere else in the country at the present time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got to wind up right now. I just want to say I really appreciate your hard work over the last, going on to 6 or 7 months now.
Yeah, 6 or 7 months.
Really appreciate that. Keep standing strong, brother. I'm pretty sure that people listening to us are keen. If you want to do something over the Christmas so-called holidays, think about if you're going west, call in and contribute in some way to this struggle because it's for all of us looking after our country.
Stop driving past, bipping on, pull in and check us out.
Well, let them know they're welcome, brother. I'm pretty sure they'll come and support you.
Yeah, Delhi.
All right, brother. Thanks so much for coming on. We've got to wind up now. We've got a minute and a half of our show to go. And I just wanted you to have the last say, bros. All right, mate. Thank you so much.
Nakanya.
Yeah, that's Zelenik Gunatamara, Ewan Gunai. And he's up there on country trying to defend the last little vestiges of our sacred culture here and lands.
All right. Thanks for tuning in for this 3CR Human Rights Day special here on the Black Block. We're going to try and shoot down, I think, to get to Bourke Street there. There's a gathering.
A death and custody issue.
And related to today, human rights. So
yes.
That's happening at 1.
Also, stay tuned to 3CR because following this program is a special from the West Papuan mob. They're going to take up that next hour explaining what their situation is. I'm pretty sure around the same issues as well. So stay tuned. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. See you during the week. This is, I'm going to wind up with a Guniandi elder, Dad Mervyn Street. You'll hear his voice now.
We don't want to let them die out, that song and dance. That's why I'd want to pass them on the dish too, and do what I can carry on from there and keep them going, you know.
It's kind of... Mare manina, mare manina, bidivana, varvana. Mare manina, mare manina, bidivana, varvana. Mare manina, mare manina, bidivana.